Our guest today on the Cafe, Steve Earle, has been a man possessed since getting sober. He's writing a novel. He's recorded great album after great album, including his latest one, Washington Square Serenade. He's fallen in love, gotten married again. He's moved from Nashville to New York City. His new album is in many ways a love song to the city that never sleeps. We'll hear performances from Steve's concert at World Cafe Live and conversation. I began by asking him about Tennessee, a song called Tennessee Blues. I commented that to me it was not so much anti-Nashville as pro-New York City.
It's not so much about Nashville or New York one way or the other as it is my needs at this point in my life. You know, it's, you know, people change and they grow. And, you know, if I hadn't changed, really fundamentally, I'd be dead. So this whole concept of flip-flop, the idea that when people change their minds, it's a sign of weakness. And, you know, that's, to me, the opposite is true, because I would not be here right now if I wouldn't want to completely, totally change the way I think about things. And I did realize that I was able to live in Tennessee for me as long as I did, because I wasn't there very much. And what I mean by that is I needed to walk out my front door and see like a mixed race same sex couple holding hands, because it makes my it makes me feel safer at this point in my life. And I considered leaving the country after the last couple of elections and all the stuff that was going on, but then I figured out that I could just go to New York and that I'd see, I feel like more like I was a citizen of the world rather than somebody riding around in a car insulated from everybody else. I know everybody on my block, in New York, and I don't know anybody in Fairview, Tennessee, and I've lived there 20 years. And it was just something I desperately, desperately needed.
New York City, a great European city.
Yeah, I mean, people say that, but I think it's, what's more important is it's the only world-class city in the United States. There's some that are close. Really, really close. And I think Philly's in there. There's, you have, I think San Francisco's in there, but they fall short on certain points. You got to have public transportation that can get you anywhere in the city and on the first leg of a journey to anywhere in the world. And most of the other cities in the United States fall short on that, if nothing else. And you got to have museums. You got to have live original theater. You have to have, you have to have original rock music, original jazz, classical music being presented for the first time. Those things are important. They're like not electives. They're like, and there's cities like that all over the world, and we have a shortage of them, suffice it to say, considering how big a country we are and how powerful we are in the world.
You talk about not being in Nashville that much in a number of different ways, but when you first started coming to Nashville, you went back and forth a bunch too, didn't you? I mean, you weren't there.
I lived there I moved there in 74, but I hitchhiked there, and I didn't have very much stuff. And I went to San Miguel Allende between 1977 and 79. That basically happened because Towns Van Zandt decided that he was going to settle down and live somewhere. And I gave him my cabin, and I went originally as a sublet, and I went to Mexico, and I retained driveway rights. I would drive back up every 4 or 5 months. I had a publishing deal. You couldn't wire money into Mexico in those days. It vanished off the face of the earth if you did. So you had to like have it wired someplace in the States, and I'd have to come north about every 3 months and get some cash.
So that famous house that Towns lived in the woods was your cabin?
It was my cabin. Wow. First. It had no running water. It had an outhouse. It had electricity, but it had no running water. And I actually found the place, and it wasn't even for rent. I talked the owner of the land. A friend of mine lived on another house on the property. And I talked the guy into letting me clean it up and make it habitable. And then I was there a couple of months, and Towns came, and he was staying with me originally. And then I eventually just turned it over to him. It was, I think, my original rent there, I think, was $35 a month. Wow. When we hooked electricity up, they went up on us to $60.
When you first met him in Houston, were you already doing any writing at all, or was he like the inspiration for the whole lifestyle?
No, I was writing, but I mean, I started writing, when I was 12 or 13, but my first 15 songs all had girls' names as titles. And I had a friend named Marshall Fortescue who wrote this song that was so ingeniously constructed, he could change the girl's name and it would still rhyme. And he only had to write one song his whole life. I still think he's a genius. But I started writing because I discovered that I learned what that line in parentheses under the title on a record was, because I noticed that the one on Beatles records said Lennon and McCartney. And so, oh, these guys are writing these songs. You know, it's not enough just to learn how to play guitar, you know, if you want to get the girls and write the songs with the title. So it was just, you know, it was, I learned pretty early that songs came from somewhere and started trying to do it. But Towns was the first person that I ran across that it was real. I mean, there were a lot of things that people talk about Towns, and there were a lot of things going on there, a lot of which weren't positive. But I did know even then that I was seeing someone that had made a decision to make art for art's sake, and whether he made money or not. Now, he did plenty to sabotage himself. Trust me, I was there, and you know, that's another issue. But he had made, you know, he was somebody that was talented enough to be, you know, a mainstream, you know, like, you know, pop or rock singer that with a big audience, but he made certain decisions to do things a certain way. And it probably limited his audience, not as much as it probably didn't need to be limited as much as it was. Some of it was his fault, but I knew that I was looking at somebody that had decided that they were going to make art for art's sake, you know, impeccably, you know, no matter what happened.
But when you got there first time in Nashville, were you thinking of, you just got sucked into being a songwriter because that's where the money was easier to make, or were you always looking to being a performer?
You mean being a staff writer?
Yeah, exactly.
None of us thought we were going to be the next, you know, Ronnie Millsap. Me, Guy Clark, Richard Dobson, David Olney, any of the, you know, the crowd I hung out with. We didn't think that, but neither did Roger Miller. Roger Miller was like, you know, became a recording artist almost by accident. You know, Willie Nelson did, and you know what? It took Willie Nelson until, you know, he was almost 40 before he sold any records. He made records, but no one ever heard them. And there was definitely, there were powers that be in Nashville that definitely didn't want to see singer-songwriters happen there. By the same token, before I got there and up until I actually got there just as the guard was changing, there was a time when publishers like Bob Beckham and Bill Hall and, you know, like knew that if they, Buddy Killen, that if they, that to get Help Me Make It Through the Night, they had to let Kris Kristofferson write The Silver Tongued Devil and I. But we were all folkies. We were all, you know, we all, you know, like had long hair and took drugs and were not, you know, even close to Republicans. And you know, we were a subculture. And they, as far as they knew, the original gatekeepers in Nashville, they considered us to be necessary, and they just sort of left us alone. And they would, you know, if the people that knew how to handle us, you know, we'd get really good, find really good songs when they came in. We were the night shift, and we'd leave really good songs on their desk. And we just thought it was a way of funding art. We didn't know what we were going to do or how we were going to make a living, and we didn't care. We really genuinely didn't care.
Well, here's that song about the other end of that experience, about leaving Tennessee and going to New York. This is Tennessee Blues live on stage at World Cafe Live with our guest Steve Earle.
Sunset, my mirror, pedal on the floor, bound for New York City, and won't be back no more. Won't be back no more, boss, won't see me around. Goodbye, Guitar Town. Ghosts out on the highway, voices on the wind, telling me we may never pass this way again. Voices on the highway, angels beckoning like a long lost friend. Fare thee well, I'm bound to roam. This ain't never been my home. Strange in my mirror, lines around my eyes, string around my finger, but I don't remember why. Don't remember why, boys, don't remember how. Goodbye, Guitar Town. Well, I'm bound to roam. This ain't never been my home. Blue dog on my floorboard, redhead by my side. Cross the mighty Hudson River to New York City side. Redhead by my side, boy, sweetest thing I found. Goodbye, Guitar Town.
Excellent.
This sort of came about from the coldest night of the year in New York City last year, and standing in the back of this ancient synagogue that's become a venue, really beautiful venue on the Lower East Side, and watching my wife sing.
My baby, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine. My baby, sparkle and shine, everyone knows she's fine. She blesses all that she sees, a toss of her hair and a kiss in the breeze. But she don't love no one but me, and I can't believe she's mine. Shimmering, she moves, sunlight all around her. Even when she's blue, silver clouds surround her. My baby, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine. My baby, sparkle and shine, everyone knows she's fine. My baby swings down the street, big, tall, high heel shoes on her feet. Walks by and my heart skips a beat, and I'm stumbling like a fool. She give me something so sweet that I can't sleep, y'all, and I can't eat. Sparks fly whenever we meet, and I'm breathless 'cause she's so cool. Anywhere she goes, I can only follow. She'll be there, I know, when I wake tomorrow. My baby, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine, sparkle and shine. My baby, sparkle and shine, everyone knows she's fine. Everyone knows she's mine.
Thanks.
Sparkle and Shine, I guess, Steve Earle on stage at World Cafe Live with a song about his wife. And last few albums, it's been duets on almost every one of them. And so did you kind of have to manufacture? How did you get this one together?
Well, this one required a lot less acting than the other ones. It wasn't, you know, it was one of those things. The duets are, they began, the purpose written duets began with I Feel All Right, I think, with the Lucinda duet. And then there were a couple with Emmy. And then
you know, I was trying to figure out who, you know, the obvious thing was to do another one with Emmy for the bluegrass record, but I was at a festival in Australia watching Iris Dement do her set, you know, to sing a song. And I'm like, that's who I need to write a song for that. And then one with my sister that I wrote for a movie called You Can Count on Me, which it didn't end up in the soundtrack. And, but it's one of my favorite of all the duets. And it was written literally for the film and about the characters in the film, because the movie's about a brother and sister. But with, you know, so Allison, our relationship began because I got into a thing of hiring opening acts that, you know, girls that could come out and sing duets with me, because I love the duets. And it goes back to my sister touring with me on the Transcendental Tour. Garrison started two tours with me, you know, sing, you know, taking that part, being opening the show and being duet partner. And then Allison came out on the last tour, and all hell broke loose. And, you know, it changed both of our lives. And so this time I got to write it for someone that I genuinely love with all my heart. And it was different. It was a different experience. I mean, I can do the other thing. It's my job. But this didn't require all that. And I'm really, really proud of it. And it's Allison started it. We started with an Allison melody and an Allison title. And she's also a writer on the song.
A co-write, and here they are on stage with Days Aren't Long Enough.
Tears have fallen. I don't ever count them, 'cause I'm surrounded by your love. Days are never long enough. Four more seasons on parade show their colors, then won't happen to us, darling. We'll remember how it was, then begin again, because days are never long enough. Time's never late, isn't bound by fate. Try as we may, love might never be found if we wait until the sun comes up on another day, my love. Days are never long bound by fate. Try as we may, love might never be found if we wait until the sun comes up on another day, my love. Days are never long enough.
Days Aren't Long Enough for my guest, Steve Earle, on stage at World Cafe Live. And once again, that's the new album is Washington Square Serenade. And I want to play one more from the concert. I want to get to it in a second, but I wanted to talk a little bit about Pete Seeger, because you do a song on the album for him, Steve's Hammer. And when did you first meet Pete?
Well, I met him originally by proxy through, you know, the guys at Appleseed Records, and, you know, who basically manage him, and because I was involved in the second Where Have All the Flowers Gone record. And, you know, he's been one of my heroes for as long as I've been doing this. And it was a huge honor to get to do that. I recorded Walking Down Death Row. Then on the third record, you know, Billy Bragg and, you know, there was like four or five of us ended up on. Pete decided to re-record Bring 'Em Home, which he had originally, you know, he'd originally written during the Vietnam War. And, you know, and it still makes as much sense. And it's the idea that, you know, a lot dissent was successfully shut down during this war by saying, ah, you're not supporting the troops. It was something that was, you know, that only, you know, some rednecks and, you know, in New York City got away with during the Vietnam War. And, you know, it takes a long time for that opinion to turn around. But the idea was that, you know, that we are supporting the troops by advocating bringing them home today. And we're also supporting the Iraqi people because we've completely and totally destroyed their country. And they're going to have to live with the results of that for several generations themselves.
And has he heard Steve's Hammer? Do you know, get any reaction from him about it, or do you know?
I haven't heard anything about it. It's pretty early. You know, yeah, the record's literally been out a couple of weeks. And, you know, I had to turn down. Tim Robbins called me and wanted me to go up the river and, you know, to Pete's. He was mainly wanting me to go up and hold his hand because he had never met Pete before. And I've never been up there. And I had to turn it down because I had something else I had to do recently. I need to get up there and turn myself. I'm actually working on a musical. I've stayed in touch with Pete's management, you know, the whole time I've been doing it. They are aware of it, but I think I found somebody to perform it. And it's basically a one-man musical called Dangerous Songs, and it's based on Dangerous Songs, which was Pete's like first post-blacklisting record in 66. It's actually the record that Walking on Death Row was part of, and it's the Exile on Main Street of folk music. It's a really incredible record from beginning to end, and it's also it's based on that and Pete's testimony before HUAC, before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which happened in New York City, not in Washington. And it's really important. Pete used the same defense that the Hollywood 10 did, which, in other words, he did not take the Fifth Amendment. He cited the First Amendment. In other words, that I shouldn't be allowed, required in a democracy to answer questions about my political affiliation, period. And he did offer to sing for them constantly during the entire proceedings, and they never let him sing. So basically, the show is called Dangerous Songs, and it's about what if Pete had sung before HUAC. That's what the idea is.
Well, with that in mind, let's go to the stage and do the song you finished up with today, which is a pretty powerful anti-war, pro-peace song, Jerusalem.
Senses again. Looked into my heart to find. I believed in one fine day, all the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever in Jerusalem. Maybe I'm only dreaming. Maybe I'm just a fool, but I don't remember learning how to hate in Sunday. school. But somewhere along the way I strayed, I never looked back again. But I still find some comfort now and then. When the storm comes rumbling in, and I can't lay me down, and the drums are drumming again. I can't stand the sound, but I believe that one fine day the lion and the lamb will lie down in peace together in Jerusalem. Then, yeah, there'll be no wiry walls. We can wash all this blood from our hands and all this hatred from our souls. But I believe that on that day, all the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever in Jerusalem. Yes, we must believe in one fine day. All the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever in Jerusalem.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Steve Earle. That is Jerusalem, live on stage at World Cafe Live. The new album is Washington Square Serenade, and our thanks to Steve for joining us. We got some more Texas music from Lyle Lovett coming up. We get back here to the World Cafe.